Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. As a high school freshman in New Jersey back in 1973, our English teacher asked the class to go see the movie The Exorcist, and he enjoyed telling us about the sexually perverse elements in the movie. Years ago, we listed that on the radio as our reason number 126 to keep your kids out of public school. Well, I've been reading a book, Darwin Day in America, by one of the fellows of Seattle's Discovery Institute. And I tell you, I'm a grown guy, right? I've been reporting on the radio for a quarter century now about the moral freefall of America. Well, this book, One Day in America, is so chilling, so terrifying, so horrifying, it makes that film, The Exorcist, seem like a comedy, as it describes the rise of totalitarian science. So 6 o'clock this morning, I'm at a local coffee shop reading, and a young guy, he points to the cover and he says, "Darwin Day, is that the new paperback from John West?" And I ask this guy, "Yeah, how do you know about John West?" And turns out he's a recent college grad, extremely well read, and he read the hardback that came out, I think, on the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth. And now there's this paperback edition out with a very up-to-date, horrifying new chapter on the rise of totalitarian science. The author is Dr. John West, senior fellow at Seattle's Discovery Institute. So what an honor to have on Real Science Radio. Dr. West, thank you for writing Darwin Day in America.
Well, Bob, thank you for having me on so I can talk about it.
Yeah, it's horrifying the way you present what happens when we elevate science, scientism above morality, ethics, and mankind being special.
I think that's right. I think oftentimes people think, you know, the ideas we have, they don't matter, sort of ivory tower. But I think the real point of my book is try to show that ideas do really have consequences. And both Darwin's idea that we're really nothing more than animals and that we're the product of an unguided process has had huge repercussions. And then just more generally, this idea of pseudoscientific explanations claiming that we're just matter in motion and that that's all there is and that's why how we should make our public policies has also had tremendous consequences. So as you point out, the new edition has a whole chapter on the totalitarian science or the rise of totalitarian science. Right. And what I mean by that is the effort to misuse science as if it should control everything in society, from our morals to our religious beliefs to social policy.
And I've been reporting on science for a quarter century. Dr. West, I don't recall any of the laws of science that use the terms right and wrong. Have I missed those? Are they in, like, advanced chemistry?
I think they're in sort of advanced social Darwinism.
Yeah, so if you have governments that say we're going to base public policy on science, then obviously that's a foundation that is amoral. And so science might tell you what happens if you use a chemical weapon in Syria, but it can't tell you the rightness or wrongness of any action.
That's right. Of course, we want to follow good science and where it is appropriate, where it has something to say, but science is not a substitute for good ethics.
Sure. So if we could, I'd like to dive into some of the particulars in your afterword, the new chapter. But, you know, the book, it was a complete and fabulous book before the afterword. But maybe you could highlight a couple thoughts from the book before we get to the new chapter.
Sure. Well, the book, and people can find more information about it at darwindayinamerica.com, but it first sort of talks about the rise of this materialist idea that we can just be explained as matter in motion, basically from the ancient Greeks, some of the debates, all the way up through Darwin. And then it starts looking at the various areas where it really impacted. So there are several chapters on criminal justice, how the idea that we don't have free will or personal responsibility have really impacted our criminal justice system. Then there are several chapters on economics and welfare policy, something called the Eugenics Crusade, where we had leading biologists at Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Stanford, push that we needed to breed a master race and to curtail breeding by those they thought were evolutionarily unfit. And so there are several chapters on basically economics and social welfare. Then there are some chapters on education, dealing with sex education and science education and how those really have been impacted by these scientific or pseudoscientific ideas. And then finally, wrapping up, which talking about bioethics and medicine and things ranging from abortion to assisted suicide to euthanasia and how this materialist idea of human beings really has impacted that.
Maybe we could just touch on a couple of those issues. You mentioned that we're just matter, so we're not responsible for our actions, criminal justice. The ACLU attorney, famous Clarence Darrow, I think he may have been the one who represented the famous murder case, Leopold and Loeb.
Yes, he did.
Where he argued, and maybe a tangent on that, Dr. West, there's a film on the Scopes Monkey Trial called Alleged, produced by Fred Foote. I think Fred has been a friend of the Discovery Institute, and I'll be seeing him in Dallas. There's a creation conference in Dallas at the Henry Morris Group, so that'll be real fun to see. Are you familiar with that film, Alleged?
Yes, and I am. In fact, I was one of the technical advisors on it and was able to be actually on site when they were filming it for one of the weeks that they were filming it.
Wow.
Yeah, Fred is a great guy, and it's a really fascinating film that's also somewhat fictionalized because it's a story, but it's far more accurate than the Inherit the Wind propaganda that so many of our students actually have been exposed to in countless generations of teachers assigning Inherit the Wind to sort of teach them about the history of the evolution controversy, which it teaches us more about sort of the propaganda of the debate.
Yeah, and Clarence Darrow, who he gave up, he didn't even give his closing arguments with the Scopes trial, and the ACLU actually fired him, if I recall. And yet,
they did hire some other people for the appeal, yeah.
And he argued that you can't hold people accountable if they murder because that's just how we're programmed by evolution. And you talked about Darwinism and criminal justice. I believe Harvard was the center of this thought that, well, just as organisms evolve, so too criminal laws evolve. And so what was right yesterday isn't necessarily right today. What was wrong yesterday isn't necessarily wrong today.
That's true, and also the whole idea of the evolving Constitution, that the Constitution doesn't have a static meaning and that judges should help it to evolve into radically different meanings according to what they think are the dictates of the time. Woodrow Wilson, our president in the early part of the 20th century, who was also a political science professor, was a big proponent and actually gave a campaign speech, I talk about it in my book, citing Darwinian evolution as the reason why our Constitution had to evolve and that we shouldn't really rely on the founders' idea of a Constitution that provided sort of permanent limits on government that was based on the idea that there was a permanent human nature.
Mm. And not everyone in the audience will know you speak with some authority on these topics. You have a degree in communications from the University of Washington, but then you went on to get a PhD in government from Claremont, and you have taught political science and history at California State University, and you've chaired the Department of Political Science and Geography. I really like putting those two subjects together in a department, political science and geography, at Seattle Pacific University. But so you know what you're talking about. And when we divorce then fundamental morality and mankind being special from our public policy, criminal justice, we end up viewing human beings like animals and treating them like animals.
That's true. And it's, you know, some people think the abuse excuse, so we let people off so they're not responsible for their crimes. And that is part of it. But it's also exactly what you just said. It treats them like animals and dehumanizes them. So there's another side that I talk about in the book, a really horrific history of things like lobotomy, forced sterilization, other things, other really invasive treatments in the name of, well, this is just like a disease, so we're going to treat it like that. So we'll lock you up until you have been treated sufficiently to be cured, and the cures may be really horrific things, like the lobotomy, where they took a modified ice pick and sort of tapped in your frontal lobes and did violence to your brain, thinking that they were going to cure you, but in fact, it didn't really have very good outcomes.
And that goes back a bit in history, but with your updated chapter, maybe we could talk about this National Institutes of Health research. They funded a research project on premature infants that was horrific, and we could probably update it with very recent news, the undercover videos of Planned Parenthood selling, which violates federal law, selling fetal body parts. So how about this? When I read this, Dr. West, we're speaking with John West, who is the author of Darwin Day in America, How Our Politics and Culture Have Been Dehumanized in the Name of Science. I've been reporting on these types of developments in our culture for 24 years. I was not aware of this until your book. So I don't know whether to thank you or what. It's so horrifying. But this study of 1,300 premature infants, could you describe that to us?
Sure. And I want to make clear, you know, the goals here were noble. They were trying to find out what is the sweet spot, what is the best amount of oxygen to give premature infants. Because if you give them too high, they can become blind. If you give them too little, they can die.
Right.
And so I understand no one debates that they were not trying to find something useful. On the other hand,
in that program, it started
not guinea pigs.
Right.
And so what they did is, first of all, they basically lied to the parents about the dangers of the study, so they didn't give really informed consent. Now, for some parents, they gave a little more, and some they really didn't give, and so they really hid the possibility of severe harms from many parents who signed up for the study. Even worse, and they didn't disclose this to parents, is that to do the study, they decided to change the oxygen equipment so they would give false readings to prevent doctors and nurses from tailoring the oxygen levels to the infants based on the infant's own needs. So what they wanted to do is they wanted to assign people into, you know, higher or lower oxygen and not allow the primary caregivers, the nurses and the doctors, to be able to know what oxygen was actually being given to them. So if they saw, oh, the baby's in distress, we need more oxygen, they turn it up, but in fact it wouldn't actually give them more oxygen. And they never told this to the parents.
And not only that, when Francis Collins, you write about him, he of course was the head of the Human Genome Project, and he was selected by Obama to head up the National Institutes of Health. And he's a Christian, but he is harshly opposed to any discussion that you could see in life the hand of an intelligent designer, which is especially startling coming from someone who names the name of Christ. But he has defended not only the project, like you said, the goal of this was to figure out the best way to provide for infants in distress, but he also defended the way the research was done. And when he published a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine about it, he failed to disclose there that they actually recalibrated the equipment so that the medical staff would not be able to know how they were caring for the infants who were their patients.
That's right. I mean, he was a one-man PR crew for this. You know, just to be clear, the study itself started under the George W. Bush administration,
yes,
but it continued into the Obama administration. And then when the facts started to come out, and one part of the government, to its credit, said, this is wrong, basically, Francis Collins went into full-time spin mode and pushed back and tried to prevent any sort of accountability. And I think this is a cautionary tale for people who think, oh, just get people of faith in government. Well, if you get people of faith in government who are indistinguishable from anyone else, there's not going to be a difference. Francis Collins, not only, you mentioned the issue of design, he was chosen by President Obama because he's a big-time supporter of embryonic stem cell research. He actually is unwilling to criticize eugenic abortions, abortions of handicapped infants. Pretty much his views on most issues are indistinguishable from the very materialist that he would not want to say he was part of.
In his BioLogos organization, they are theistic evolutionists, and the theism part is just an adjective. The substantive there, the noun, is evolutionist, theistic evolution. And it's really indistinguishable from atheism, from materialism, as far as a worldview. If you see the hand of God in the conception of a child in the womb, then theistic evolutionists who reject intelligent design, they object. And they say, no, there's no evidence there that there was a creator God, that there's an intelligent designer.
I want to be clear. I think there are many different varieties of theistic evolution, and so I wouldn't go quite as far as you just said, but I would say with Francis Collins, it's clear on his beliefs on life issues, let alone on design, and on ethical issues in medicine really does seem to be indistinguishable from the same secular elites that you would think that we would be skeptical of. So that's disturbing. It is.
And Dr. West, you know how prevalent that is? I don't know, of course, but I was invited by some alumni to speak at Pepperdine University earlier this summer, sort of a protest conference, because their faculty there, they are theistic evolutionists, and they are harshly opposed to even the claim that we could see the evidence for design in living organisms. And that's a Church of Christ, you know, ostensibly a Christian faculty that's harsh in their opposition even to intelligent design. And so I can't distinguish atheism from their worldview.
I think that's certainly true for some strands of theistic evolution, which probably would be better called theistic Darwinism, and trying to somehow attribute the world to an unguided process, that God authored this unguided process, which doesn't quite cohere logically.
Dr. West, have you heard about these undercover videos? There's now a second one out of Planned Parenthood executives being asked at what price point would they sell baby body parts?
Yes, I've actually seen the first one. I've heard about the second one, haven't seen it yet.
Yes.
And the unfortunate thing is, as I write about in my book, this has a long history, fetal experimentation, even on live babies inside the womb, has had a long history, and so this unfortunately doesn't surprise me. Also, Planned Parenthood, I talk about the history a little bit in my book. Of course, one of its founders, key founder, was Margaret Sanger, who was a huge social Darwinist and a huge eugenist, trying to breed a better race and to stop the people she thought who were unfit from breeding. And so this is in the organization's DNA.
In their DNA, in fact, at American Right to Life's website, they have an article, Margaret Sanger, in her own words, and they have scans of pages out of her books, Woman in the New Race and The Pivot of Civilization. And John, she writes in Woman in the New Race, she writes that the most merciful thing that the large family does to one of its infant members is to kill it. Now, I know that she came out against abortion early on, because really, she was pushing birth control.
Yeah.
But there, she comes right out and talks about infanticide, that would actually be more merciful than letting these poor slob families raise yet another kid. In her book, Pivot of Civilization, page 112, she describes handicapped. This is her quote. The blind, deaf, dumb, mute, and epileptics are the dead weight of human waste. And she is a hero to this day to Planned Parenthood and the left.
Yeah. I mean, it is rather shocking, and they sort of sugarcoat her and airbrush her. But what you're saying, people should know, is you're not just cherry-picking quotes. Go to virtually any page in some of her books that you've mentioned, and you find this, comparing people to weeds, comparing them to waste, comparing them to parasites. She attacked the very idea of humanitarianism and altruism as things that were dangerous. I mean,
well, it goes back to Thomas Malthus, and right up the street from Real Science Radio Studios, we have a late-term abortionist, infamous Warren Hearn, and he has described human beings as a tumor, an infection on the planet. And so when he kills a baby, he's helping to fight back cancer. And so it's this dehumanizing view. And speaking of which, on page 390 of your book, this is just devastating to read, and I've recently done a program on the tolerance of pedophiles. Mm. With all the outrage against the Duggar family and Josh Duggar, we contrasted that. He was a boy. What he did was horrific, but they were calling him a pedophile on CNN. And then we listed the actual pedophiles who've either gotten a pass or tolerated or celebrated by our culture, and there's a shockingly large number of them, and including entire organizations and media outlets that have advocated for decriminalizing pedophilia. But in your book, you talk about a resurgent effort, like a revival of part of the homosexual movement back in the 1970s was to defend and to promote child adult sex. Well, there's been a bit of a revival.
Yes, and just to be clear, it's not just among homosexuals, it's heterosexuals. As I write in my book, the origins of this idea really come from, among others, Darwinian zoologist Alfred Kinsey. His whole approach to sexuality was very Darwinian in that he said if you could find it somewhere in nature, either in some of the mammals, some subpopulation, or some subpopulation of human beings, then it's equally natural. It's normal mammalian behavior because, by definition, if there's some characteristic that even if it's in a subpopulation, it must have been selected for in that subpopulation. And so you can't say it's better or worse. Now, Kinsey himself didn't go all the way to say that child adult sex was okay, although he poo-pooed it. He went to great lengths to say, well, the only thing that's really concerning is that we make such a big deal of it. That's the victimization. His followers and his colleagues, after Kinsey died, went the next step. And by the early 1980s, they were actually CICUS, the Sexuality Information Education Council, which is the biggest sex education lobbying group, as I talk about in my book, in the United States still. It really dictates most of the curriculum in many of the schools. In the 1980s, they were publishing books that featured the work of, among others, sociologist Floyd Martinson, who wrote whole essays about how childhood is the best time to learn. And so things like incest and pedophilia and things were perfectly good. And so then there was a revulsion of that in the early, mid-80s, sort of along the lines with the Reagan Revolution and a lot of things, sort of there was a cultural correction on some things. Yeah. But now what we're seeing is exactly right. There was a conference I talk about in the book in Cambridge University where out-and-out pedophiles making the arguments again. And
That pedophilia should be decriminalized. And this was
normal.
This was a 2013 conference at Cambridge University, which is respected around the world. But in our list of organizations and leaders who have defended, advocated pedophilia, like you said, of course, it includes heterosexuals, but there are a horrific number of homosexual leading publishers like Allison Press in Boston and Out Magazine and The Advocate, who have defended, tolerated, celebrated sex with children. So then this becomes more horrific now. And this is what I meant when I described this as like reading a horror film. You talk about the APA, the American Psychiatric Association. So this is not in England. This is in the United States. And could you describe what happened there in 2012?
Well, there was an effort to basically, of one of their working groups, expressed a concern that their criteria for pedophilia, as it existed, only applied to adults who desire sex with children 10 and under, and they proposed amending the criteria to make it clear that they applied to adults who wanted to have sex with children between 11 and 14. So that was commendable.
So, because if there's a predator going after 12, 13-year-old boys, clearly society has to do everything we can to protect those kids and to make sure that everyone knows that this is unacceptable.
Yeah, and I would say, again, boys or girls.
Yeah,
because,
right.
But the big but and the thing that was really shocking and that is in 2012, the overall association rejected the proposal to tighten up things so there wasn't this loophole. And so, which has just caused a lot of discussion. Well, why did they do that? And the practical effect is to basically try to give a pass that if you're wanting to have sex with kids, you know, over 10, that that's okay. I don't think that's not the majority opinion even in the APA right now, but the concerning thing is it seems to be moving in that direction, and that is appalling.
Well, when the APA rejected that proposal, then obviously there's significant influence at the top that is bringing us back toward that horrific period of the 1970s where they wanted to normalize sex with children.
Yeah, they're basically taking off where things stopped and, mm-hmm. and trying to push it again. And I think that's true.
You point out that they've been passing laws. I'm from New Jersey. And I think you said California and New Jersey passing laws where young people who may be in turmoil over their own sexual identity and sexual desires cannot get help from licensed counselors.
This is, I have to say, the most, to me, one of the absolutely most concerning public policy development in this area right now. It is so horrific. It's basically legalized child abuse. And since I wrote the book, Oregon has passed something similar, and I think Washington, D.C. Other states, mercifully thus far, have it down. So you're exactly right. The surveys show, you know, when people start to develop in puberty, there are lots of different conflicting feelings, often transient. So these are kids are really vulnerable. So what they're saying is that if you're 13, 14, 15, and you are struggling with your sexuality, and say you happen to be a committed Christian, and so you have one view of your sexuality, and you have some feelings, you don't know what to make of them, they're saying you now do not have the right. The state forbids you, or actually forbids licensed counselors from being able to help you come to terms with your feelings in a way consistent with your own religious and moral beliefs. The only thing they can do is basically say, well, you have those feelings, you should be proud of them. If someone is like 15 years old and is really disturbed by them and wants a more productive way to think through this and to have a view more consistent with their own ethical beliefs, they're left out to dry. And in New Jersey, there's this, as you're probably aware, since you're from there, this
yeah.
really awful, horrific case of it was like 15-year-old devout Catholic teen who was suicidal,
yeah.
not feeling, you know, that comfortable being male. He was able to get some licensed help when he had a non-licensed help. It wasn't very productive, but he got licensed help, and then it really helped him. And so to be able to feel, you know, satisfied with what he was, you know, who he was. But once the law was passed, frankly, was okayed by your governor, Chris Christie, he now can't get a licensed therapist or licensed counselor in New Jersey.
Yeah, and you point out in the book, and I appreciate you being even-handed, you say that Barack Obama's administration, their scientism, it's not unique to just one party. It's reflecting the trends that span both political parties, and that's another part of the reality that your book is opening the eyes of so many people. We're about out of time, Dr. John West. Just real quickly, in your book, you talk about the redefinition of marriage since the book came out. Now the U.S. Supreme Court has given the Roe v. Wade of marriage and said, in their opinion, a homosexual marriage has to be accepted. We think that the lower magistrates, that states should reject that. But you point out that many people have begun losing their jobs, even careers, because they think differently, because they think marriage is between a man and a woman. You mentioned the Benham brothers, whose show was being promoted on HGTV, and it was canceled. We had, in fact, Dave and Jason Benham on the show, just wonderful Christian men, godly husbands and fathers. It's getting worse. If it's known in your corporation that you think homosexual marriage is wrong, you could be in jeopardy of losing your career.
That's true. Or if you're a small business person in my home state, Baronelle Stutzman, this grandmother, really wonderful lady, had a flower shop, served everyone, but wasn't willing to participate in a gay wedding. And, you know, is in a community where there are many other options. And so now she may lose her business and livelihood because of that. And so I think people need to wake up to the sort of persecution and really threats to freedom that are happening under this. And also on the redefinition of marriage, there is a book called Sex at Dawn, bestseller by two evolutionary psychologists, that is now advocating that marriage itself is against our biological reality, so we need to redefine it to multiple partners, basically as many as you want.
Right. And why stay within one species? So, Dr. John West, two things, the recent film festival in Las Vegas and the cruise last summer. You, with the Discovery Institute, hosted a science cruise to Alaska. what a wonderful time. I was there with friends. What an enjoyable, in fact, a lifetime memory. Thank you for that.
Well, thank you for coming. It was special.
Yeah, and your family was there, your children. They were part of the crews that was helping to administer the whole conference. So they were just fabulous also. And then the film festival in Las Vegas recently, it was at a Sin City theater.
It was not the place I would usually go. But yeah, the Anthem Libertarian Film Festival, it's a big film festival, and they screened a film I did, a short film called Biology of the Second Reich, which is just 14 minutes. You can now watch it online, that tells the history of how these Darwinian ideas impacted Germany in the years before World War I. And I think it's a real eye-opener to people.
And there was standing room only, literally. Held about 200 people. A lot of people were standing. Many people were turned away. So with your permission, we'll embed that, the entire film, in the show summary for today's interview so folks will be able to see it.
That would be fantastic. And I'd encourage people, if they want more information on my book, again, to go to DarwinDayInAmerica.com. They will actually find there in the multimedia a 3-minute little video that summarizes the entire book in about 3 minutes. Mm-hmm.
Fabulous. Thank you so much, Dr. John West. It's an honor to have you on Real Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So that, of course, is the author of the book, Darwin Day in America. And we will link to the book. We'll link to Dr. West's website. And the video, the film, The Biology of the Second Reich, not the Third Reich, but the Second Reich. I was able to enjoy a screening of this on the cruise last summer, and very significant, like the entire book, like our interview today, very important to understand where we've come from so that we'll know where we're headed. So this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams in Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.